This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Ralph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Project, welcome back to this very special episode. Today, we were fortunate to have on an Australian sporting legend, but maybe just in New South Wales. This man is Anthony Minichiello. I know a lot of you listening right now have probably not listened to the podcast before, but just saw that we had Minnow on and support the Roosters and the NRL, and just thought, you know, why not? I'm going to listen to a podcast with Anthony Minichiello. So if you don't know who Anthony Minichiello is, so the Sydney Roosters is basically currently the best NRL team, which is rugby league, right? The National Rugby League. Yeah. And he was basically the best player for a very long time on the squad. And for many people in the organization would say the best player of all time in that team. Some would say the best fullback of all time. But I've started to find out, if I start saying that, there is some serious controversy around that. So there's a lot of varying opinions on that. Regardless, he's always in the mix and the conversation about one of the great players of the era. If you know anything about rugby league, their dudes on there are in serious shape. Mm. They're very fit. They're very strong. Yes, they're not without their controversies off the field, but on the field, these guys are incredible athletes. And it was very, very awesome to be able to sit down face-to-face in person with one of the best of all time. I grew up watching this guy. Wasn't a huge fan of rugby league, but I mean, of the small amount that I watched, this guy was always on TV. Yeah. So it was cool to be able to sit down, really talk about retirement, talk about what it's like post-athlete life, talking about the kind of health he's into after, talking about how he managed injuries. I think that was one of the coolest things. The kind of injury journey he went on throughout his career, and people telling him, hey, it's time to hang it up, it's time to retire, it's time to give it up, and just not taking no for an answer until he felt like he was ready on his terms to hang it out. So some pretty cool stories there.
Yeah, it's probably one of the best comeback stories in Australian sports of the last 20 years. Yeah. You have some, but he's got one of the best.
One of the best, absolutely. So thank you, Minnow, for coming on the show. Thank you to Steve who connected us. So hopefully do another one again in the future. And maybe if you guys really enjoyed this, get some more NRL players on. So as well, guys, supporting the show today, obviously good grooming in the NRL should be... It happens upstairs. The boys definitely take care of their fades these days. You want to take care of your fade downstairs as well. Cleaning up downstairs, I think, as a man, is one of the most critical things in 2020. It's an absolute mandatory thing if you're a single lad. I don't know what girl these days finds it acceptable for a guy to be completely untamed down there. In fact, I've even heard the word used unhygienic. Wow. No matter how well cleaned it is, no matter how well cleaned it looks, if that thing's just out of control, I don't care if it's hygienic, it looks unhygienic, and that's enough to turn it off, and that's enough to ruin your chances, lads. So if you want to increase your chances, all you need to do is go to manscaped.com. The hygiene kit is what you want, because the hygiene kit gives you the Lawnmower 3.0, which has the skin-safe technology, so you're not going to nick yourself. And it's battery-powered, it's waterproof, it's got everything you need, it's shockproof. But you also get the ball creams. You get the Crop Preserver, the Crop Revitalizer, and they're just amazing smelling creams. It's like, it's a whole level of treatment that you'll love to perform on yourself downstairs. So manscaped.com, the hygiene pack, and the code is MMP. That's going to get you 20% off, and it ships all over the world. So no matter where you're listening to this, you can order the Manscaped hygiene pack. Highly recommend it. Been using it pretty much every day since. Of course, guys, as well, one of the other companies I absolutely love, and I've talked about this all the time, is the apparel company RecGen. Now, we have struggled for a very long time to find an apparel company we were happy with, just because most apparel companies are either super goofy like Gymshark or they're really focused on women. Mm. RecGen is the baby brother to Zainrobe, which is a men's fashion label which has been around for over a decade, and they know what guys like. They're on the cutting edge of fashion, and they've given you stuff that isn't too loud, but it's subtle, but it's nice. If you wear RecGen, people compliment. They go, what is that? That's really nice. That's a little bit different. It's a little bit edgy.
Yeah, and if someone tries RecGen, particularly a guy tries the t-shirt, they always say, man, I can't believe how good this shirt is.
Oh,
and I think also it's partly because it's the only apparel that is really also designed for like functional fitness, people that actually train hard. It's not just like a bodybuilder that's just like, they train hard, but you know, not moving around, maybe not hitting the ground, stuff like that.
Yeah.
This is really designed to look good in the type of gym where you want to look good, which is where a lot of us train these days, and train hard, sweat, and not want to stink after the session.
Yeah, absolutely. These shirts will not stink. They've got amazing technology. They're lined with silver, and silver is antibacterial, and that's how it keeps the smell out. So if you guys want to get free express shipping worldwide, anywhere you can pick up this gear, you go to recgen.com. That's R-E-C GEN.com. And if you're not ready to commit to anything right now, just go follow them on Instagram and just watch the pieces and the drops and the different stuff that comes out. And when you like something that pops up, go ahead and buy it. Use our code MMP. That's going to get you 15% off the entire order. MMP is going to get you 15% off the entire order. That's when you go to recgen.com. All right, guys, here we go with Anthony Minichella. My must project. So today, I don't think we've ever had on someone like an Australian sporting legend. This will be our first one. I think the closest one we had was Andrew Lauterstein, bronze or silver medalist in the Olympics against
Michael Phelps. Well, we've also had a Commonwealth Games gold medalist weightlifter.
That's true.
Ben Turner.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. But I think none as well known as you, Anthony. So we'll always do a little intro to this so people will know who you are. But yeah. It's cool to get someone on who, you know, even though I didn't watch a lot of rugby league, it's hard to avoid it when you live in New South Wales.
Yeah, that's it.
And it's hard not to support the Roosters when you're kind of in the east/North Shore. So it's good to have you here. And there's a lot I want to talk about. But just to kind of catch people up, because it's a very international audience as well, give us a little bit of background on you know, your career and some of the highlights, I guess, from your perspective, because, you know, the highlights you read on the internet are maybe not always the highlights that you have in your mind. And
yeah, for sure.
We know you also like played for Italy and some stuff as well. So
Well, firstly, thanks for having me on, boys. It's great to be here. Yeah, so I played rugby league for 18 years with the Sydney Roosters, one club player. I grew up southwest of Sydney on acreage, Italian heritage, and signed at the Roosters when I was 16 years of age. 3 years at lower grades and end up making my debut in the year 2000. It's 19 years of age, and the rise from then was pretty quick. Grand final in the first year, even though we lost that one. But, you know, as a 19-year-old turning 20, you play in one of the toughest sports in the world and you get to play a grand final. It's like, hey, good start. That was a good first year.
It's a good start.
I ended up playing in 6 grand finals in the end and winning 2 of those, one as captain, and got to represent my state and New South Wales Blues and win 3 times there, then represent my country on 19 occasions. And then towards the end of my career, represent my heritage, which is Italy. Captain the World Cup, Italian rugby league team, which was great experience.
It's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of ups and downs along the career, I'm sure we'll get into today. But all in all, it was a pretty amazing career. When you look back at it, I had some good fun, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I wanted to start with was, I'm sure you probably watched some of the Netflix documentaries that have been coming out. Like, the first one that comes to mind is The Last Dance. Did you watch the Jordan documentary? I think everyone knows. We're on lockdown, right?
Awesome.
So, for a guy like yourself, you know, you have, you know, your lives didn't necessarily cross paths, but follow the same trajectory in many ways, like being one of the top athletes in your sport, really well known. Did you feel like when you were watching that documentary, it's almost like looking into a mirror in some ways?
I'd like to think that. I'm sure, you know, the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan on a much bigger scale, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I remember following the Bulls back in the 90s and Michael Jordan, just one of the all-time athletes in our world. Just watching that was just getting insights into, you know, how not dominant he was on the pitch or the playing arena, but off the field as well, and the influence he had on other players and the organization. And watching real stories like that really fascinates me. And because you can see just the way he sort of worked, the motivation, and, you know, if someone didn't say hello to him or put him down, then bang, it's in the memory bank.
And
next time we play,
it's on the list.
You know, that's awesome. I love that stuff.
Yeah, and is that, and you related to that? I mean, do you see those sort of qualities in yourself as well? You're like, oh, that's, I feel like I'm wired that way as well. I feel like I have that obsession.
Totally, because, you know, I'm not a big guy and I played a contact sport. So I was, you know, told many times, you know, I don't know if rugby league's for you. Or, you know, when I was coming up through the lower grades, because my dad made me get a job as well, I was doing a trade as a shop fitter or detail joiner, and I would always leave TAFE at 3 o'clock when it was still 2 hours to go. Right. I had to get the training. So I just kept leaving at 3 in afternoon tea, and the teacher would always say, what are you doing leaving? You got to finish your course. you know, I'm going to footy training. Goes, well, that's not a career.
Yeah.
And what do you think? That's going to be your career, playing footy? And like, he always used to tell me that, and that was in my head. So that was in my memory bank. So that was one of the driving forces, I suppose, when you're pushing through hard sessions, that voice in your head saying you can't do that.
Mm.
So yeah, I definitely related to Jordan and the way he sort of went about his business.
Mm.
And people did criticize it, like, hey, he's too negative or he's too harsh. Do you think that it's a healthy type of motivation to have?
Well, I suppose it all depends on how you're wired individually. You know, I suppose with some people, too much criticism has a negative effect on people. But for me, I've always been sort of intrinsically motivated from within. So if someone says you can't do that or, you know, puts you down, then I'll go the other way and make sure that I can achieve it to try and prove someone wrong. And I suppose that's what happened when I had some injuries through the mid part of my career when, you know, professional doc was saying you should retire.
Yeah.
That was one driving force to get back and show them that, you know, that's not the case.
Yeah.
Mm. And so taking it back to when you were getting started with the training, obviously rugby league is so different to when you started. It's where it is today. A lot of sports, right? A lot of sports didn't have, even when Jordan started, like it was, the NBA was nowhere near what it is today in terms of the money and the attention and the people playing in it. So how does, I mean, besides, you know, the guy at TAFE telling you that, you know, you're never going to make it, what, you know, how do you decide that this is going to be your path? Like, what was it about league that you chose?
Well, my two main sports at a young age was gymnastics and little athletics, to be honest. Okay. I got a younger brother. Combo. Yeah, I know. I got a younger brother who just finished his professional career in England last year as well. And he started league when he was six. He's 18 months younger than me. I didn't start league. I did gymnastics at age six and seven and little athletics. So I was going to state for tumbling and trampolining and long distance. So cross country, 3K, 1500 meters at athletics. It was just a family friend that was a gymnastics coach. I grew up outside Liverpool and there was a big gymnastics center at Macquarie Fields there. And I just started tumbling and ended up being pretty good at it. Mm. But, you know, those two sports are very much individual sports. And then a mate at school at age 10 said, mate, why don't you come join our local rugby league team? We're all joining. Come with us. So I did that. Fell in love with the game straight away because of the team aspect of it all. Mm. You get to hang out with your mates and train.
Mm.
So slowly I gave up gymnastics and athletics and just stuck solely with rugby league. And after that, it was, you know, the rise was pretty quick. Mm. But I learned quickly from my parents. You know, my dad worked three jobs growing up. And my mum drove us everywhere, cooked everything from home. So we were always taught that work ethic is vital to succeeding in life. So younger brother, younger sister, we're always told that. So the work ethic was always there. And we're always naturally fit because we grew up on 5 acres, riding bikes and motorbikes and driving cars at young ages and always outdoors running. So naturally you get a natural fitness from that. So whenever I go into a team, I was sort of always at the top end fitness-wise. So you have this belief within and then you've always been told that work ethic is vital to succeed. So you have a strong work ethic plus the fitness, then you can work on the skills. So that's what happened at a young age.
So were your parents the first generation to live in Australia or did their parents?
My dad came out when he was 13, grew up Naples region in Italy. My mum was born here, but her older sister, same region in Italy, in Naples. And so grandparents all from Italy, dad from there. My mum was born here though.
How did you not get pushed into football? That's what I want to know.
This is what my wife says all the time. Why didn't you play football? You could be overseas earning squillions. But it was just weird. I don't know. Like, I've played like tennis and swimming and the two other sports I mentioned and league and never played soccer.
Right.
It was just the area that we lived in was more rugby league, and I got into athletics, gymnastics, and never gave soccer a go. So that's
different life, maybe.
Different. That's right.
Yeah. So you were for the people listening, then your parents were not that traditional.
Both my parents never played sport. because my dad came out when he was 13, 14 and was grew up in Melbourne and was put to work straight away from school and was worked. They had acreage and dairy farm, so working on the farm. And my mum grew up in a strict Italian family and, you know, no sport was allowed to be played. They had to work and they were on 10 acres as well and they had to look after the household as a young girl. So it's weird. You know, my sister was a pretty good netballer. Brother played professionally as well and so did I. But it was something they never got to do as a kid. So whenever we asked, oh, can we play this sport? Can we do that? They were like, yep, go for it.
Right.
My mum drove us everywhere. My dad provided all the I suppose, signing up fees and all that type of stuff. So we were pretty lucky that we had the opportunity to do whatever we wanted.
Yeah, that's cool. It's almost like it could have gone either way, right? It's like, no, we have to do it on this path and it's exactly how you can do it. Or it's like, I don't want you to do this path. I want to give you every opportunity to do something else. Which sounds like what you got, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like that work ethic that you were talking about, I feel like obviously is essential for sports. When it comes to when you're progressing up through the ranks, for me, it seems like from all the people that we've sat down and interviewed, like work ethic, everyone has that. Everyone sits in that chair and they says the same thing. Like, I have that internal work ethic. So for me, I feel like there's more than just the work ethic. Or do you feel like it is the work ethic? Maybe
like
people's maybe people's perception of how hard they work is different. Or
no, there's definitely another level to this, and that's the mental side. So what I always say is, how do you separate the guys that don't make it and have heaps of talent, the guys that have strong work ethic? Most of them do. The good players to great players, or the players that don't make it.
Yeah,
it's normally the way they prepare mentally in their head and their self-talk within, can you just say you've got young kids or you've got a girlfriend, you've had a massive fight and you come in the training and you've still got that, you're carrying that baggage. So you don't train to the best of your ability. Right. You don't perform to the best of your ability. The great players can put whatever is going on outside their lives or outside the football training field, they can put that aside. And they can come in and train and focus on what they need to do, and then they'll deal with that later. Most people, or even when contract time comes, I've seen this so many times. As soon as they're coming off contract, they feel like they need to be signed to have comfort. So they're always worried about, I'm unsigned for next year. So everything just goes out the window, and they can't focus on what they need to focus on.
Do you think because they're like a bit insecure about their abilities?
Well, it could come down to that, or it can come down to, again, can they separate what needs to happen off the field to what needs to happen on the field? And that's what the great players do. They separate that, or they leave the baggage to the side. They go and focus and train to the best of their ability so they can perform, and then they'll deal with that. You know, my last 5 years of my career into my 30s, I did one-year deals every year, just one year. And normally it was towards the end of the season. It was getting towards September, October when we're done. And say to the chairman or the club, yep, let's do another year. So I always just left that aside. Because if you're playing well and you're focusing on what you need to do, all the other stuff looks after itself.
Yeah, it's almost like that saying, it's like, what have you done for me lately?
Yeah.
Right? It's like, yeah, you scored all those tries 5 years ago, but like, what did you do yesterday for me? And I think maybe people rest a little bit on their laurels. So now when you see young guys coming through, I feel like this is, I was going to talk about this later, but I feel like it's a good point to get into it now, is they have, it almost feels like because of the phone and because of social media, it's like maybe before when you were coming up, you can probably talk about this, is like, you know, a couple of guys on the team got all the media attention, but there was no way for, you know, the other people to get access to the fan base and the attention as much, right? Because there was one TV camera or there was two TV cameras, one interviewer. But now everyone has their own TV camera, their own network that they can access people, their own source of distractions and sponsorships and all that stuff. So you still work at the club and you've seen this kind of shift with, you know, this new social media age. What effect do you think it's had on the players versus in your era?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge, I would say, because it can be used to benefit, or it's a massive distraction as well.
Right.
So trying to find the balance between the two is vital, and that's where good sort of coach and good leaders come into it. I got the best of both worlds, really, where in the early 2000s, there was no social media, no camera phones.
Yeah.
And then mid-2000s, it all started to break out. So distraction, obviously, it can be huge. You know, always looking on your phone. Because what you find now is if you got your phone everywhere and you're always looking at it, there's no social interaction with players, building that connection. Because, you know, on the field, things happen in a split second and you're under fatigue. You just can't think that quick. It's just got to happen naturally. But how does that happen naturally when you're not building those connections at training or on the team bus or, you know, just being around the players? So some coaches, you know, when they go to team outings or bus time, they ban mobile phones just so they can just start connecting with each other again. So finding the balance is, I think, is key, because technology can be used to a huge advantage, and that's what it has done in professional sport over the last 10 years now, with analysation of games and post-match interviews and, you know, access to the fans and sponsors, which is never seen before, all those insights that they get, which was never there before, you know what I mean? So it brings more dollars into the game as well.
Yeah.
So having a balance is definitely the key to that, for sure.
And you seem to manage the media attention that and the business side of sport along with the playing side of sport. And like you mentioned before, being able to separate those worlds. So how do, like, what were some of the strategies you used? Did you just have like a really good agent, or did you just, you know, say, okay, only this time I talk media, or how did you keep those worlds separate and not have it, you know, play into what you did on the field?
That's a good question, because that is another challenge in itself, because sometimes I felt if I did too much media, then it just distracts you from your mental preparation. And I used to visualize my game a lot, from that visualization of the mental prep and obviously your physical prep. So again, finding what works for you is key. And, you know, most young guys, they don't know what works until you're older and more experienced. Right. And they know, you know, if I, I just might do one or two interviews today, or I'm on media call on Wednesday. That's it for me for the rest of the week. So that's where a good coaching staff or a good media manager comes in a team environment. But then as you get more experience, you work out what's what you can handle or put on. Because sadly, as you get older, you got to spend more time on yourself and your own preparation, especially away from the sport.
Sure.
Because, you know, you got young guys that are in their early 20s, you know, over 100 kilos, fast, strong, powerful. And you got to be keeping up with them, these guys, when you're in your 30s, you know what I mean? So it's important to work out what works for you. And I suppose for me, it wasn't living rugby league 100% of the time either. You need a mental break as well.
Right.
You know, and that's, my wife taught me that. She's in fashion, you know. So when we both got together, it was completely two different worlds coming together. But sometimes it was a good thing, because I'll go and support her at a fashion show. And, you know, I'm not thinking about rugby league. I'm just getting, you know, chatting to different people.
Yeah.
Completely not about footy all the time, you know what I mean? And that gives you a mental rest as well. So finding that balance was good for me, I think.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if you've watched the Joe Rogan podcast much, but Andrew Huberman is a researcher at Stanford. I keep bringing up his research because it's so fascinating. So he's a neurobiologist, and he speaks about, when it comes to visualization and skill learning and preparation, in order to solidify those new skills and the stuff that you want to improve upon, by, you know, you take a certain physical path and you want it to be ingrained and have it happen naturally, you need downtime. Like, that is literally the time in which it solidifies itself into the nervous system. And so if you're always on, if you're always wired, you're never having that downtime. He said the downtime is like daydreaming. It's like, you know, napping. For some people, it's meditation. And he's like, or it could just be a time when you're just really not thinking about anything. You're just kind of cruising around, which sounds like potentially when you have that thing that's not rugby league or it's not your absolute focus all the time, it allows you to kind of rest and recover and regenerate.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I've always been able to visualize my game as a young athlete. And then towards the end of my career, it turned into more meditation. And again, you know, sometimes you have that afternoon nap and you dream and whatnot. So I've always done that as an athlete. I followed Joe Dispenza quite a bit as well. And, you know, the power of your thoughts and, you know, new wiring in your brain, all that type of stuff. So, you know, if you think about it, then you believe it and then you actually train it, it can happen.
Yeah.
So that's real interesting space. Yeah, I love it.
So take us through what a visualization process looks like. Is it on game days, the night before? How do you kind of
It's probably about 2 days out before a game and maybe a little bit the night before.
Okay.
Try and get the prep done. You know, your physical prep's almost done, and then a couple of days out, you just sit there before bed or even in the morning after a stretch routine and just close your eyes, and I visualize what I want to do in the game. I always visualize myself under fatigue, but pushing through that fatigue to do something amazing on field or whatnot, or just having a real solid game with no mistakes and all that type of stuff. But always visualize myself pushing through fatigue, that barrier that you need to push through, because every game you're under fatigue.
You need to
find something at some point to push through that. So I'd always visualize that and visualize my game, real high end stuff, and then some other lower end stuff as well.
Yeah.
And we try and visualize it like exactly as it happens, like in real time, is it a kind of a slow mo thing? I always wonder, like, do you try and replicate the game in your mind and replicate plays that maybe you've pre-planned in your mind, or it's like a general gist of how you think the game goes?
I visualize my game like just being everywhere, because I was a fullback, so I could get to go anywhere on the field. Visualizing myself supporting forwards and then out in the back line, chiming in or catching high balls was huge.
Yep.
You know, the visualization of that is massive, because as a fullback, you get bombs kicked up to you consistently every game. So, you know, I practice physically on that after nearly every training session, high balls, low balls, but then thinking about it and just, you know, dreaming it up or visualizing it, low, high, heaps of catching stuff, catch pass, tries, all that type of stuff I would visualize. Because, you know, when you're in the stadium and it's 80,000 fans, you know, you want it to be automatic. You don't want to be nervous about it. You know, I always went into a game confident if I had done the training, done my extra catching, and then done my visualization, I'd always go in confident. But if I didn't do one of those things, there was a bit of doubt left in your head. And once you got doubt, that's when mistakes happen.
So how often would you go into a game with doubt? I mean, there surely had to be instances over your such a long career where you did those three things, but it didn't play out how you wanted it to. Would there then be a moment where you question, did I do something wrong? Do I need to change things? Do I need to...
Not in my visualization. Like, things never happen to plan.
Sure.
You know, it's a live sport. It happens split second quickness, all that type of stuff. But you know, the training comes into it. So, you know, if something didn't go to plan, and then I'll revisit, you know, what I did in my physical prep this week. Well, what did I do in my prehab, my recovery, video work, and my catching, my extra catching. If I drop something, then I'd, instead of doing 10 or 20 catches, I'd do 50 or something like that, and just get more muscle memory up, get more confidence with it, and then making sure that I'm on point with my visualization as well. If I did those things meticulously, you know, 9 times out of 10, you'd always have a decent game.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always think about how the greatest, most legendary moments in sport usually, or what defines someone as a champion, is how they come back from their lowest moments. So like, to give you an example, like one of my favorite sports is the UFC, and I always talk about it on the podcast, but to give you an example within that sport, Ronda Rousey, who was like the really famous female champion for ages, she basically ran through the entire division. But the moment she hit her first bit of controversy, she just couldn't come back from it, right? So in my eyes, I feel like, well, you're not that much of a champion, because you just dominated everyone. But then when you lost, you had no ability to come back. And so she just went and did, like, I don't know, WWE or something, and stuff. But then you take the same, but the male version, you take Conor McGregor, right? And he's same sort of thing. He's blitzing through everyone, and then he lost. And then it was like, okay, does this guy, is he a Ronda Rousey? Is he just going to fade away and we forget about him? But no, he came back and he avenged himself from that same opponent. I was like, this is what it takes to be a true champion. So for you, What do you have a particular moment that stands out for you where you felt like, man, my game is just terrible right now and I don't know if I can come back from this, or maybe it was a particular injury, and how did you work yourself out of that situation?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, look, couldn't agree with you more there either. Like, I think true character comes out in times of adversity. Mm. So, you know, for the first 6 years of my career, I made my debut at 19. I didn't get injured. Not one soft tissue injury. Whoa. Not one injury.
That's great. Like, hand of God.
And I was in 80 kilos. I was 88 kilo.
Yeah.
You know, light compared to everyone else. So I grew up on a farm, as I said, mentioned earlier. So we had our own cows and chickens and eggs and veggie patches and fruit trees. And the whole Italian culture is to grow your own, cook your own. That's what we did.
Right.
So I had a great foundation built up without even knowing it of whole fresh food.
Right.
Moved out of home at 18, obviously, because I was traveling in for training and didn't want to do that, wanted to be closer. So that's when, you know, you just start eating out and, you know, it's a bit of a drinking culture back in the game in the early 2000s. So after every game, it was on. Yeah. And we're good as a team then, so we'll always play Friday nights and you had the weekend to yourself. So it was just all on the weekend, enjoy yourself, have fun, and just turn up the training on Monday. Mm. So, you know, those first 6 years... You know, I played more games than anyone out of the NRL consistently. Wow. You know, playing in grand finals and representing a state and country. And 2006, it all come crashing down. You know, I had in 2005, I probably had my best individual year. We didn't make the semi-finals that year, but, you know, I won all these great awards, individual awards and the Golden Boot and all that type of stuff. But I had a few signs with my lower back that used to flare up. But, you know, I was like, yeah, let's get a cortisone, get guided cortisone in, just get it done and play the next week, you know? That's what I was doing because, I thought everyone was saying, you got to look after your back. You got two bulging discs down there. Anyway, I wasn't listening to that because I'd have fun on the weekends, train my butt off all week and then go play a game and I'll be killing it.
Right. So it's working. What's the problem?
Why would I change?
Yeah.
2006, it all come crashing down with a ruptured disc in my L5S1, lowest disc in your back. Play the first six games, and I was playing with constant hamstring pain, but it wasn't hamstring pain. It was actually nerve pain running down my left leg. And I found out that I got ruled out of the Australian test game, actually, and got sent to a specialist. And he said, mate, you got a ruptured disc in your lower back. So I went in and got an operation, probably one of the first in the league at the time. But I thought, you know what, I played more games than anyone. I'll just take the rest of the year off and come back bigger and better in 2007.
Yeah.
So I did that. Still hadn't changed anything. I was on anti-inflammatories morning and night and prescription medication, left, right and centre.
Even in your off-season?
Yeah. Like, off-season I wasn't... In pre-season, I was doing 20 inflammatories in the morning, 2 at night, daily, every single day. Shit. Not in the off-season.
Strong ones as well, probably.
Yeah. Like, I thought they were helping me, but they were causing more issues down the track. So 2007 rolls around and I play the first 10 games and I get selected back in the New South Wales Blues team. I play game one, I'm in camp for game two. Literally just roll out of bed to put my socks on and I click in my lower back and back goes into spasm and severe nerve pain down my right leg this time, the opposite leg. I lay on the floor and I'm stuck there for hours and I had to pull out of that game, get sent back to the surgeon. Specialist is looking at it and goes, mate, the disc above has done the same thing.
Oh my God.
He goes, what do you want to do? Do you want to come back and play rugby league? I was like, yeah, I'm 27, of course.
Yeah.
He goes, well, we'll have to do a bit of a small operation, try and not affect the structure of your spine. I'm like, okay, let's do it. Anyway, I go in for that op and I come out of that op. And with the first op, my nerve pain immediately subsided. I went, oh, that's great, because it's just gnawing at you every single day. Mm. This operation, I still had a bit of nerve pain in my right glute, and the doc goes, there's just a bit of inflammation around the operation, it should be fine.
Mm.
Anyway, I always felt that I had something there, and I had these explosions of pins and needles in my right hip for a year after that. And anyway, I took the recovery a lot slower, and I'm preparing for the 2008 season. And I play the first six games and I'm just literally on the bench press and I just push a rep out and I pinch a nerve in my neck. Don't think anything of it. Go out and play the game. Towards the end of the game, I call for the water bottle and I go and squeeze it and my wrist just caves in. I had no power in my left hand. I couldn't even get the water out of the bottle.
Oh, shit.
And I'm like, shit, that's weird. You know,
drink out of the other hand.
Yeah, that's it. Swap the bottle.
Fix that one.
Leave that one alone. Anyway, I tell the doc after the game, after I finish the game, and he goes, that doesn't sound right.
Oh, you played the game.
I finished the game. Yeah.
Well, how do you throw the ball without a limp left wrist?
Well, look, I still had movement. It's just I had no strength in my... Right. Yeah, it was only about 15 minutes ago. Anyway, I told the doc, he goes, that doesn't sound right. He sent me in for an MRI that next day. And I'm on field training. It was a short turnaround that week. And I remember our physio just comes tearing out down the field and he's like screaming my name. Mini, 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 get off the field, get off the field. I'm like, what's going on here? So I pull back from the playing group and he goes, mate, your results have just come back. You've got a significant disc bulge in your C5, C6 vertebra. Like you're 1 millimeter away from your spinal cord. Like any type of hit could put you in a wheelchair. Anyway, I'm just like in shock. I'm taken back. We walk off to the side of the field and I'm just, you know, I didn't know what to say really. Like a million thoughts are going through my head. And I'm like, I've had two back operations already on my lower spine. I had a smaller disc bulge in my mid-back thoracic. And now I've got a huge disc bulge in my neck. Now, what the hell's going on with my spine?
Mm.
So again, we go back to the surgeon. I'm there with my physio and we're sitting there. And this time they MRI my whole spine. And I remember the surgeon, he's just looking at this image, looking at it. I'm like, what's the verdict, doc? And he goes, I think you probably should find a new career. And I said, why is that? He goes, every single disc of yours is black. You know, they're dehydrated. Like, I haven't seen this in someone so young in that's playing professional sport.
Mm.
It's pretty hard to rehydrate a disc again. You know, it's pretty hard to come back from this point. You should probably find something else to do. So that gets filtered back to the club, my club. And I was still on contract for another year. But, you know, the last 3 years, I've had all spine injuries.
Mm. Yeah.
So they basically didn't know what to do with me.
Yeah.
So I was pretty lucky at the time I met my wife. And she was always asking me the question, like, why? Why is this happening? You got to find out why, why? Mm. You know, I've seen... All the best specialists. Sure. We're a professional team. We get access to the best.
Yeah.
And they were just saying, look, it's pretty hard to come back from this point. They were treating the symptom, basically. Sure. Have some more inflammatories. Have muscle relaxants. Have sleeping tablets. You just got to manage this for the rest of your life. You know, and that's when I start, you know, papers, you should retire. All this stuff was coming out. You've had a good career today. You know, you should retire. And that wasn't what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So that's with the encouragement of my wife to go and find answers, I went on this huge quest to try and find someone that will give me the root cause of what was happening, why was this happening to me. And I went to countless amount of physicians, doctors, specialists, trainers, all that type of stuff, and basically most of them were saying the same thing. And that's when I met Aaron McKenzie, who had his home studio, functional movement studio, and ties in a lot of nutrition and lifestyle with his training. And I remember sitting there. And he said, look, you can repair your spine if you're willing to make some sacrifices with your lifestyle and nutrition. And I pretty much invested in that straight away because he was the only guy that gave me some real confidence.
Yeah.
You know, and back in 2008, you know, functional movement training in rugby league wasn't around.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all heavy lifting, weight lifting, power lifting, all that type of stuff. So I would train in Aaron's gym. He would film me the program. I would bring that program into the Roosters gym. I'd have my phone set up and I would watch it and train that cable stuff, one-legged, dumbbell, all this type of stuff. And even the Roosters like, oh, just leave Mini on his own. He's been injured for the last 3 years. Let him do what he wants.
Yeah.
So that's what I was doing. So I thought I was on the right path, right? I was on the right path. I was preparing for the 2009 season. Round two, and I do all my ligaments in my ankle, syndesmosis, so the three major ligaments that hold the both bones together. And the rotation force was so heavy that the force went all the way up my fibula and I had a spiral fracture in my smaller bone, my leg, out for another 22 weeks. So coming off contract as well. So this is a huge test, you know, test of character, like we were speaking about. And I remember sitting in hospital with my wife and it's like, you know, you're going to be right. It's like, coming off contract, no contract. Then I remember speaking to Aaron. He goes, mate, this could be a blessing in disguise because you can actually take two steps back from week-to-week pressure of training and getting your body prepared physically, mentally, to go into battle each week, where you can just take those two steps back, start to build your foundation a lot stronger and really start to focus on your nutrition and really start to fine-tune that. And that's in 2008, that's when I started... That's when I got into the research around whole fresh food and the power that food has on healing, recovery, regeneration of the body. And that's when I started on that journey of evolving and learning and, you know, just becoming more of a leader in that sort of space, becoming more of a professional athlete off the field, really.
Yeah.
So I changed everything. I got rid of all the protein shakes, the Gatorade. I did all natural shakes from coconut water, more healthier fats. The quality of my produce was meticulous, from pastured animal products to seasonal local plant foods, bone broth, certain nuts and seeds, slow cooking a lot of things to keep the enzymes in so the body can suck up the nutrition a lot more.
No stone left unturned.
No.
Yeah.
No. So I changed everything. And, you know, and you should have seen my medicine cabinet back then. Like, my wife was like, well, you're not a chemist. What the hell? You're supposed to be a professional athlete.
Yeah,
yeah. I just got rid of everything. Everything.
Yeah, right.
And for the next, those 2 weeks, I felt shit. Felt like crap. It was just like crap was coming out of my body. Mm. You know, I had stomach ulcers. I had rashes popping up out of nowhere.
Because you were using it so much.
So I was using so much crap. And after the 2 week mark, the first thing I noticed was my sleep. I had much better sleep. Much more REM, deep sleep. So that means I was waking up with a clearer head, more focused. I wasn't snappy. My emotional state was a lot more stable. And then the physical state started to repair. So my body started to repair itself naturally because I was allowing it to. Mm. And 2010 rolls around and I'm 30 now. So your class is old in professional sport.
Yeah, yeah. Done.
Yeah, done. So I play the next 5 years. Again, 1 year deals. Mm. I play the next 5 years without any injuries again.
Wow.
And, you know, I get to play my 300th game and win another grand final as captain in 2013. But the best thing that happened was when I do certain talks to people, I show this image or both two images together in the MRI scans. One's in 2007. You can just see all my discs are black, all my tissues are compromised. And one in 2014, I'm retired. All my discs are white again. All the tissues are strong, healthy, and vibrant.
It's crazy.
And, you know, all the best doctors that I had access to were saying that couldn't happen.
It's a miracle.
Mm.
That's nuts.
Yeah. So that's when you realize the power of nutrition and what you put in your body really matters.
Mm.
That's why I'm so passionate about health and fitness now.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
So you ended up retiring for just because you felt like you would accomplish everything you need to? You felt like it was time?
Well, I always wondered, you know, when people give their retirement speech.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, they go, oh, when you know, and rah, rah, rah. And I was like, I don't know. Because I won the premiership in 2013. I was 33. And let's go another year. I'm still competing and feel great, mentally fresh. And then the end of 2013, I had our daughter in December. And I'd just come back from a World Cup playing with Italy.
Yeah.
And I got 6 weeks off. So I went back to training after the new year in January. And I got to spend all that time with our newborn and spending time with her and the family. And I found it really hard to get back into preseason training. And I thought, maybe that's just because I had my first little girl and I just want to be home a lot. And then the preseason rolled on and that feeling was just there. And then I was like, shit, this is it. This is the feeling. You know, and I always watch people go, when you know, you know. I knew before even season kicked off. And I sat on it for a while, speaking to my wife about it and my family. My wife wanted me to go on and play another year, you know, because I started the season and we're doing good. We ended up with a minor premiership that year.
Yeah.
But I just knew it. I had the feeling mentally, I just wasn't there like I was the year before. And physically, I could have pushed the body another year, yes. But mentally, which is most of professional sport now is mental. Mm. Mentally, it just wasn't there. And so with 6 weeks to go, I announced my retirement.
Mm.
And I was happy with it. And a lot of people, even to date, they go, oh, do you miss playing? I'm like, not really, no. Like, I had my time and I retired on my own terms and I had MiniFit to go into, my own business. And I had a role at the club. And so the transition was really good.
Yeah. I feel like that is the piece that is missing a little bit is for some professional athletes is the path out is so unknown that it scares them from ever leaving. And maybe they want to retire. Again, the example of the UFC, you see guys in their 40s still fighting. And you're like, why? Why are you going through all this again when you don't need to? And part of me thinks is they probably spent all their money, so they need the money.
Mm.
And there's nothing, they don't know what else can I do afterwards. This is all I've known. And they find it really hard.
It's probably one of the hardest things to do is transition into normal life or into the business world or wherever you have an interest in. But to be honest, like when you do professional sport as a living, it's the best job in the world.
Yeah.
You know, you're yeah. with your mates, you train,
yeah.
your butt off, and you have these higher highs, you know, when you win premierships or representative games, and then you have lower lows. So you go through these ups and downs, and it's pretty hard to emulate in the normal world.
Right.
So what most people miss is the camaraderie of that and those highs when they when you get them. So professional sport, when people retire, is bloody hard. You know, I think, you know, even though my transition was a lot smoother than others because I stayed at the club for 18 years and I had a role there, I had Minifit already set up and had some other stuff to go into, I still think it was even 4 years for me to really transition into what I'm doing now.
It's almost like you have to detoxify from the highs and lows, like the drug, because there's no high that's likely going to be the same
for your brain. It's true. You know, you like, you know, grand final and like the pressure and the build up or an Origin game, like the media is all over you all week and you come out and it's like 80,000 fans and you just have that perfect game and it's just, you hold up the trophy and you just all this elation and you know, it's pretty hard to emulate just on a normal working day.
It's like, yes, made a sale. Like, not quite the same. Yeah. So how do you make peace with it then? If it's like, obviously, you don't want to deny the fact of how good it was, right? You still want to cherish the memory, but you don't want to chase it in your normal life because you know it doesn't exist. So, what was some of the process that for you? I can't imagine it was, you know, it was easy.
Yeah, it's not easy, but I was pretty lucky because those injuries that I just talked about, I went through a huge transition period of learning. About evolving myself to have all this knowledge in health and fitness and nutrition. And now I've seen the results in my own body. I've seen the results in other people's bodies and the other program I work for, the Change Room. So now that's become my new passion, you know, helping others achieve their health and wellness goals and seeing the results that others can make just through, you know, nutrition alone. You know, it's huge. So I'm pretty lucky that I had my injuries, you know. I suppose it was a dark time at the time, but looking back at it now, that sort of made me who I am now.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I do what I do now, because of those injuries. So I've got a new found sort of drive and passion or new road to go down. And, you know, some people don't have that. They're still looking for that, you know, that extra game or that extra fight, you know, and I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like the shape you're in now and the skills that you've acquired with handstands and bodyweight training, which are difficult skills, not many guys keep a passion for any sort of training after
most of them are fat.
Yeah. Well, they just associate training in the gym with work. And they're like, well, I retired from work, so I'm not going back to work.
Yeah, you know what I mean? That's true,
In a way, I guess
they used to get
lucky.
Paid and now you have to like pay for a gym membership. Like, what the fuck is this?
It's a big transition,
Yeah.
So, I mean, for you, it's obviously different. You're able to, you know, find a passion and keep training because you love it and stuff. But I even see it with just even some of the athletes that we've worked with in the past. If they don't have a competition to train for, they don't have an event coming up or whatever, they don't see a reason to train. Training for health and well-being is just not enough of a reason. And I can imagine for a lot of your past colleagues, it would have been a similar thing. How do you keep yourself motivated to train regularly and stay in really good shape and look after yourself?
Yeah, it's a good one, because it is when you get handed a schedule when you're playing professional sport and you've got, I've got three weight sessions on that day, I've got this, got wrestling, got skills. It's all handed to you. You know what I mean? So when you retire, nothing's handed to you. You got to go out and do it yourself. So people that aren't that motivated get themselves into a rut. And, you know, I've had plenty of mates that are in that or have done that, and then they get some light where they train for this certain event and they drop off again. And you know, all the stuff that I read and people that I follow, you know, I want long-term health. That's my goal now. You know, I was performance, you know, but health and performance, you got to find a balance, because if you have peak performance, you can't have peak health. You know, it takes away from the other. I want sort of peak health now, where, you know, living past 100 is a goal, you know, it's a definite goal. But you got to start now. Otherwise, you know, you can't start when I'm 60. I've got a few issues, got a couple of chronic diseases. Let's start now to get to 100.
Let's get this. Let's cross off some of those chronic diseases. Yeah, Where should we start?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I just love, but you know, when you eat well and you intermittent fast and you train, just the clarity and the focus that you feel, and then you have a drink and you feel like shit for 3 days. You know, you go, well, I want to go back to the way I felt last week, you know. Yeah. And I'm not 100% like that all the time. You've got to enjoy yourself and have a good balance of life. Of but, you know, I'm 80 and 90% with my stuff. And and then you once you feel good, you feel the clarity, then, you know, why would you go back to drowsiness and dependent on coffee and afternoon naps? I need it, you know, all that type of stuff.
Yeah. And so that, like, that's obviously how you take care of yourself now. And then obviously you're still, you know, for many people, you know, a hero, or, you know, you're still well known in the communities that you're involved in. How does the Australian public kind of treat their old sporting heroes? Like, just a recent example, you know, if you followed the Adam Good story, one of the greatest AFL players of all time. And now, unfortunately, it's just this real mixed bag where it seems like half the country hates him.
What's wrong with Adam Good?
No, you don't know the whole thing.
Nah,
man, his last he ended up having to retire because they would boo him on the field every time he touched the ball because it was a whole racial issue, a racist thing. Yeah, and anyway, without boring the audience on, they can go look into the issue. But it was a huge, it was very evident that racism in Australia is still a massive part of Australian sport and Australian culture, which is very unfortunate. And forced one of our greatest athletes of all time to retire just because every time he would touch the ball, they would boo him. And he's like, I don't want to play this game anymore. It's horrific. And so, obviously, his post-career should have been so different to what it's ended up being. How has it been for you?
Yeah, I know Adam. He's a good mate of mine. Great guy. Great player, too. Yeah. It is sad that we still have, you know, racism, not only in Australia, but worldwide. Have you seen the events of this year? It's been terrible. Sad to see. It's just awful. But Adam is a great guy, great player, and look, he's doing good things off the field with his charities as well. But you're right, there is a balance of 50-50 where people love him and people not so much, you know, and that's difficult. But I've been pretty lucky that most of the fans and even fans from other teams still give me good raps, I suppose. I didn't get into too much trouble on the field at all throughout my career, so I'm another lucky one that has a good rapport with fans. And you know, I spent the time with fans too, because in year 7 I was in high school and I was at, you know, Patrician Brothers Liverpool out the west of Sydney, and we had some players come in from the local team, Western Suburbs back then, the Magpies. And I remember running up to this player, they were on their way out, and I ran up to him and I said, "Oh mate, can I get your autograph? I missed it earlier." And he goes, "No, mate, I'm going." And he sort of just brushed me. And I'm like, and that's stuck in my head. Even to this day, I can just picture him saying it. And, you know, when I'd come up through low grades and started making first grade and you get well known and kids come up to you, that was in my head the whole time. So giving them the time to do that and make their day, it only takes 10, 20 seconds, have a small chat and they're off for the day and you've made their day. So that was always stuck in my head. So I've always had a good relationship with the fans, no matter what team they come from, you know what I mean?
So even to this day, even if people stop you in public and stuff, you don't feel exhausted by it or anything?
No, not at all. You've got to be grateful because you know, the sport's given me a lot. You know, good platform to go into my business and a good profile to do some good things.
It's so... it's such a good thing. I think now what's interesting, you know, we'll come back to this social media thing, is like that our sporting stars almost feel a pressure to speak on certain issues that before they wouldn't have to speak about, on issues that they're completely unqualified to talk about, which I find is always interesting. So like an example would be LeBron James was asked about the like US and China trade agreements earlier in the year, and he made a comment about China on his Instagram or on Twitter or something, and it was just, it was just clearly from someone who just didn't know what they were talking about. Mm. But he obviously felt the pressure to talk on specific issues because he has the platform, because people expect him to say something.
Mm.
And he ends up making himself look really stupid. Mm. All right? Or he just polarizes people. Some people go, he's still awesome, I agree. Or some it turns a whole other crowd against him. So do you feel like nowadays players like need to be careful with how they voice their issues on different aspects of the sport and stuff? And if you watch The Last Dance, Michael Jordan, he's like, you know, people ask me on certain different racial issues and stuff to come out. And he's like, look, I'm just an athlete. Like, I'm just, that's what I do. I play basketball. Mm. That's all I want to talk about. So ask me questions on basketball.
That's one thing I was surprised. He was so good in interviews. Even look at the scrums of media around him, you know.
It's crazy.
And he was controlling it. That's what most people, I only got this towards the end of my career, by the way, too, because when you're young, you feel like you're obligated to answer the question, what they ask you. Mm. And now there's certain media times and everyone's up for media at certain points. So you got to speak.
Right.
And sometimes with the young kids, these reporters, they're asking questions that they probably shouldn't be, but they're allowed to.
Right.
And they're answering back. Whereas, you know, you're the one that's in control if you don't like what they've been asked. And so, you know, say what Michael Jordan said, or, you know, say, I'm sorry, I don't want to really comment on that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just a footy player as well, you know, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes when you're in that situation, you feel like you need to say something.
Right.
And that's what you need a good media manager there to teach these young kids. They're young kids. They come straight out of school, some of them, and, you know, they get a camera in front of your face, and some of them, you know, they get startled, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm.
And almost like, I think some issues will come up on just probably like even health topics. I know some footy players now, their wives and their girlfriends are really into like anti-vaxxing and stuff like that. And look, that's a whole separate issue, but they probably feel like they have to speak on this sort of stuff now. And so they start associating themselves. They pick up the phone and they maybe say something they shouldn't have said, or something that's controversial, or maybe they make some comment that's racist or just insensitive. And it only harms their career. And you just got to be so careful now with these players. Would you give any particular advice to like those young players and how they're approaching social media? Because like you said, it's a great tool, the technology, but you know, it can also really harm your career as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think just double check everything, or think about what you're saying before you put it out there, I suppose. You know, even in an interview, who says you have to answer back straight away? You know, you can think about it for 10 advice, seconds, 15 seconds. Why not?
Like,
you're the one that's in control,
you
know, not those guys. Because, you know, the reporters are smart. They'll ask questions to try and draw something out, what they want, and that's the headline, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And everyone's been in that position before, including myself, where you say something little, but the rest of the interview was great, but that's the headline. Then you go, that's the headline? What? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then people sometimes just read the headline.
Yeah.
Oh, look what Minnie said. That's ridiculous, you know?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So you got to be really careful.
And so for when you got older and more experienced, you started to learn to pace yourself more in the interviews and only, or would you start declining questions, or would you just pick out a certain reporter and just go, I'm never answering a question from you again? Or
no, I didn't ever did that to a reporter. If I didn't want to answer something, then I just wouldn't answer it. So no, you know, I won't answer that one. Let's get next question, you know. And just slow things down. Think about it before it comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's key.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Mm. So with the newer players that are coming up now, because obviously you're still involved in the club, you know, I asked a few people, I go, oh, what sort of questions should I ask Minicello? He's going to be on the podcast. And one of them, or someone said, you know, you should ask him about what he sees as the key to coaching staff around the newer players. Now, obviously, every organization, every sporting organization in the world picks and chooses their coaching staff differently based off lots of different things. And there's some really good stories. I know, I think it's John Wooden, the really famous basketball coach in America, that was like most successful college basketball coach of all time. And even just like, if you think about the USA versus Russia in the 1980 something Olympics, when they beat the Soviets and they were like undefeated for like seven Olympics or something, like how they chose their coaching staff, it was totally different to how they'd done it the years before. Obviously, the Roosters are doing exceptionally well at the moment. You're part of that coaching staff. Is there a magic formula or a way to choose coaching staff and how to build a culture around a successful team?
Yeah, there is 100%. You know, first you got to have a a coach that understands the club and the culture and the people that have gone before them, then he's got to be a good leader and respectful. You know, Trent Robinson, I played reserve grade with him in 1997 at the Roosters. So when he come back to coach us in 2013 as head coach, you know, he already knew or understood the culture of the club. And, you know, it's pretty much driven by our chairman, Nick Politis, who he's a winner. He's a billionaire. You know, he's a winner in business. And he wants the club to be winners, you know. So we strive for premierships every year. That's our goal. So Trent Robinson knew that and knew the pressure that he was coming into. So what he did was, you know, we've only got 3-4 junior clubs to pick from. You know, other teams have got the whole state, like Brisbane or whatnot, and Penrith and Parramatta. They got all these juniors to pick from. We don't have that much. So we need to buy players from other areas and bring them in. But then how do we actually get them to play for the Roosters' colours and really feel a part of the four walls within?
Not many players are actually from Bondi Junction.
Not really. We've got probably one junior player in the squad, Victor Radley, at the moment. And when I played, we had one or two. We had two, Ryan Cross, Luke Rickardson. So we've only got a very few amount of local juniors that play. So how do you get these guys into a winning culture and into the red, white and blue? And Robbo is really good. He gives you a history lesson every year on not just the club and the players that have gone before us, but the area and how we survived in the early 1900s. You know, the eastern suburbs was just really working class. People come here to work to make some money. It wasn't a rich suburb like it is now, but they worked hard, and look at it now. It's probably the best area to live in Australia, the most expensive area to live in Australia.
For sure.
So it's an area that's come good. So it's built on hard work. So he took us all the way back and got every single player to understand it. And then that's what we wanted to base our game on. Our core game was to work hard, work harder than any other team in the NRL. So then people feel a part of it straight away. And then you get some, you know, three pillars, like we call them, the trademarks. And we come up with those trademarks ourselves together as a group, not just a coach saying, this is what we're doing. This is the trademarks. It's like a discussion for hours on certain words. And this is what we're going to live by this whole year, these three trademarks.
Oh, you reset it each season?
Reset it each season.
Oh, awesome.
And then you set your standards underneath that. How, you know, what standards do we want to live by at training every day?
What's an example of a trademark you remember being a good one?
Well, our coach likes to keep them confidential. But
okay.
That's all. I'll share one. When I was playing, I've got to think about this. Hang on. It's tough, right? It's not even, you just think about, oh, tough, yeah, who cares?
Yeah.
But when we look at the meaning of behind it, the meaning was being able to withstand high amounts of pressure without breaking. So we love that saying. So that's what we wanted our defense to be like. So we can withstand all these amounts of pressure, teams throwing whatever they want at us, but we're not going to break, no matter what. So that was one pillar.
Yeah.
So that's what we assigned that to.
Right.
And then underneath the three pillars, we set our standards. So, you know, if it was a recovery session and we're on the massage table, no mobile phones at all. You know, because you're getting distracted, you're playing on your phone, but really it's a relaxation time. You want your body to recover.
Right.
So no mobile phones. If you're in the weights room, after you finish your session, you put everything back to the way it was normal. So the gym's clean. If you're taking off strapping tape and you got water bottles everywhere, everything goes in the bin. All those standards that now the leaders and the other boys in the team have to hold each other accountable to. So if someone wasn't doing that, then you have to go, mate, put your rubbish in the bin or put your weights away. No mobile phones on the table.
Yeah.
So those are our standards that you set. And then they're little things, right? But if you do those little things every single day, that's what developed into a winning culture. Yeah. That's what developed into a bigger culture on the field. When the chips are down or you're under pressure, you're under fatigue, and all those little things come into it because you're holding each other accountable every day at training. They revisit that every year in a big camp, and they change those words and they come up with the new standards for the year. And Robbo is really respectful, our coach. He shakes everyone's hand every day, no matter who you are. It's just a respect thing. So a lot goes into developing a coaching staff, you know, and a head coach, he'll set the road to where we're going, but then the coaching staff and the leaders and the captain have to drive it, you know what I mean, drive that cause. And we've got a really good coaching staff. Robbo's formulated a really good coaching staff, and that's why we've been, you know, premiers the last 2 years and challenging for a third one in a row this year, because a good coach is worth its weight in gold for sure. Yeah.
And how much do you think, because I've always watched way too many movies around this stuff, but how important is the, how articulate does the head coach need to be? Like, do the speeches need to be like Hollywood locker room speeches to get people motivated, or is that just a myth? Is it more just he sets the example and he shakes people's hands and he just has a high standard for everyone? Or
I've had both.
Okay.
Like, Phil Gould, he's Channel 9 commentator now. Very articulate with his words, amazing speaker. Like, we hired him in Origin, perfect for Origin, because it's three games, high intensity, and he'll come up with these amazing speeches and you want to just jump out of your skin. But there is a bit to that, but, you know, you need to have the foundation set first. Sure. So all those standards, all that. Then day in, day out, the self-talk that the coaches give to the players. And it's just... So I'll give you one example, is when Robbo come into the club in 2013, the year before that, we finished 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And then the year after that, we finished minor first and we won the premiership.
Mm.
But when he first came in the preseason, he challenged us straight away. He goes, you guys aren't full-time professionals. You guys are part-timers. We need to be full-time professionals. We need to be a second-half team. So the whole preseason, we trained to be a second-half team, to be better in the second half than any other team. So we would have half-time breaks at training. And then the second half, it will be just all the talk. This is where we get better, boys. This is it. The last 10 minutes. This is what we do. This is what we do. You know, and we trained the whole preseason, the whole year like that. We find ourselves in the grand final and we're down by 10 points with 20 minutes to go. And some people are frantic behind the post. And all I had to say to them was, boys, settle down. Don't say a word. Just take your air in, relax. We've done this our whole year. We've trained to be a second half team. Just do your job alone. Don't do anyone else's but your own. We go out and we score three tries and win the game by 8 points. And that's so that whole self-talk and what we ingrained in ourselves or put in the bank happened the year earlier.
Yeah.
That's what a good coach does. He ingrains those things early and you train it, and you make it happen on the day. And then, you know, a coach has to manage personalities.
Yeah, yeah.
19-year-old to a 33-year-old. The balance is, you know, it's hard. That's a management role, really. And you get good coaches that really do the coaching. And you just got to manage and balance everyone's personalities and keep them on the same page, going in the same direction.
Mm. So would you say those coaches are like amazing at like knowing how to speak to all the different personality types? Like, they have that really high emotional intelligence.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Trent Robinson does for sure. And we all did personality trait testing. So we answered like 300 questions. And
which ones did you do? The Myers-Briggs?
Myers-Briggs.
What did you, do you know what you came out as? Do you remember?
I was extrovert, but not right out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember the other four. There's four things, isn't there?
I can imagine most professional athletes would be extroverted, right?
I've done another one, and it's like a shapeshifter, so I can adjust to each one.
Each situation?
Yeah, each situation.
That's cool.
So we did that, and then we did a full day or half day on this, where we started to understand everyone's personality traits, our players, and this guy learns this way, this guy learns that way. And then we grouped them up and we had groups of the same personalities, and this is what the team looks like. So then we start to understand ourselves, how someone else learns to how I learn. And then so we're all in that together. So then you start to realize, you know, if this guy's not listening in a video session because he doesn't really learn that way. So, you know, he learns more visually on the field. So you understand all the different balances in the team. That was pretty cool to learn that, you know, and the coaching staff do that quite a bit, so they understand the different personalities and how to treat people differently.
And have you started to see how, because I mean, if everything you just said just then, if you just took out coach and you replaced it with like manager, and you took out, you know, players and you replaced it with staff. Like business, we say business is a sport. And have you seen now that you're, you know, doing so much in the business space, all the parallels that get drawn with leadership and discipline and recruiting people and finding the right mix?
Yeah, 100%. Like it's, the correlation is very similar, you know. It's, you need, if you're in a business with, you know, a team of people, it's, it works exactly the same way, you know what I mean? Like you got to keep them motivated, put that self-talk in, what you wanted to achieve, try and get them the, have input and come up with the direction. Otherwise, if you get told what to do, some people don't do it.
Yeah.
And then managing different personalities, you know, it's, it gets tough, But the good businesses, they do it great.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, you, like the captain of the Roosters, you're also like the leader of your business, right? So people turn to you and you give out the instructions and you manage the personalities and all that stuff. So really, you've been training for it for 17 years to go into business. So it's like the same thing.
Yeah, I know. That's it. That's what some people don't realize. They have great qualities, athletes that are switched on towards the end of their career to go into the business world.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like we know a lot of really good athletes and they just haven't been able to translate it into their careers for whatever reason. Whether they can't join the dots in their heads mentally, I'm like, oh, I can do this really well in training. I can just like take those skills and translate them over into my work. There seems to be like a missing piece there. I'm not sure if it's, maybe they just don't believe in themselves or maybe they just can't join the dots.
It's harder to put it into practice, I suppose. You know, sometimes you learn all this stuff, but then when you teach it, it's a different skill and different art altogether as well.
For sure.
And that's something that I've been working out, is to try and put it in place, how to teach it as well, and then execute it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I wonder, with the training that you did to repair your back, and it's obviously when you first started it, it was very different. How much of I call it strange, but the non-traditional style of training is incorporated now? Because his name is evading me. He's the Real Movement guy.
Keegan Smith. So yeah. He was on board in 2013 with us.
Okay.
So he helped us change a lot of the conventional stuff as well. So there is a mix of both now. So Keegan was great when he first came on board with us at the Roosters. So we did some weightlifting and powerlifting stuff, but we also mixed in with some functional movement and some core, deeper core training as well. Because, rugby league, you need speed, power, endurance.
Yeah.
So you need to train all those different modalities, I suppose. But, you know, being strong in the core is vital for injury prevention.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he incorporated a lot of that in there.
So a lot of that stuff has stuck around. Like it's not left. There's not a new coach that's coming and going, okay, we're taking out all like the wrist handstand prep work stuff and the dowel pass throughs or anything.
Not really, because Robbo's been there since 2013, when Keegan came on board for a few years there. So he understands that that's important. You know, some coaches don't, but our coach does, yeah.
And so not, from what you understand, not every team has taken up this more, less conventional approach.
I don't think so. I don't think every team has. I suppose even some teams with their nutrition, you know, even in 2013, we made an agreement with everyone that we would cut out the bread, the pasta, the soft drinks on any team outing or team trips away, you know, and you know, we educated the boys on how to cook their own food and quality of your produce is important. Some teams don't really focus on that at all, but at the Roosters we do a bit,
yeah. It just seems strange to me. Like, we've come so far with strength conditioning, education, and nutrition, especially in the States, right? Some of the technologies and the training and stuff, like, they're doing like genetic testing, they're doing stool testing, doing like supplement protocols. Like, they got such a high level, and yet doesn't seem like it translates that well into Australian sports. Not all, obviously, the Roosters. I feel like when I heard that stuff with Keegan ages ago, I was like, wow, these guys are like pushing the cutting edge here. And some sports definitely are, like, no doubt, but. Yeah, it's still, I don't know what it is about Australian sporting culture. I think it's maybe like super traditional and stuff. I know that even the Australian cricket team now, like doing heaps of non-conventional, like more cutting edge sports science stuff, like even just wearing like HRV monitors and stuff, like it still hasn't made its way into some of the best teams.
I know. Well, it seems like a lot of the coaches still love the way they did it when they were growing up, and they have like some nostalgia about what worked for them
when
they were growing, and then they have trouble bringing it in.
It's sadly, you know, it's, sports science is a massive thing. You know, if you can get 1 or 2% of an edge on another team or a player, then that's huge in professional sport. You know, like I would have loved to experiment with, you know, hydrogen water, red light therapy, intermittent fasting as a professional athlete. It would have been unbelievable. You know, I only got into fasting 3 years ago. You know, the red light and the hydrogen water in the last year or two. So all that type of stuff would have been great for just trying to get that little extra couple of percent here or there. You know, all those recovery modalities are pretty cool and what the American guys are doing.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, I feel like that's why they get so far ahead in so many of the sports, especially, you know, you don't really get to test it that often, except, well, the Olympics was supposed to be this year, but you know, at the Olympics, generally we pretty much get smacked by the Americans in most stuff, right? Did they win it last year? Or was that China? No, that was Beijing, China won. I think Americans won it last time. But I mean, there's a lots of factors that go into it, but yeah, their program starts, they know it starts at such an early age and, they, and they're using all that cutting edge stuff. I'm just waiting for certain Australian sports to kind of get a bit further ahead and to realize that some of this stuff is pretty useful. But I actually didn't send you these ahead of time. We send all our guests a final four question. So you're going to have to do them on the fly. So
no,
I
feel like
surely you got experience with this.
Yeah, you got experience with split second decisions. So first question is we basically ask if there's an opportunity. I know you're starting your podcast. Is there anyone that you have on the list that would be like a dream guest for your show?
Yeah, I've got heaps actually. You know, I love following all the integrative doctors over in America. Dr. Mark Hyman, if you know him, or you know, Joe Dispenza, I think we've got some links to. He's awesome. Deepak Chopra, they're big in the meditation space. Ben Greenfields, I've tried to be in contact with him. He's cool. So all those guys, that they're the guys that I follow, and I read those guys, their books,
the biohackers,
all that stuff is something that I follow religiously. So those guys will be cool to get on and just pick their brain, you know, because they're on the cutting edge all the time.
Totally.
I
remember we used to listen to Ben Greenfield when he was talking about like sauna therapy and like ice baths, and no one was doing sauna therapy and like ice baths weren't really for the gen pop, like, you know, the cold water therapy, the breathing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And now, like, you know, there's, you can go to a weekend,
that's it,
like cold therapy session. They just host them all the time now. It's crazy.
Yeah.
What sort of stuff? I mean, you mentioned red light, fasting, that sort of stuff. Is there anything else that you're doing on a regular basis, which is kind of like real cutting edge?
Just, no, it's not cutting edge, but the diaphragmatic breathing stuff. You know, we got links to a good friend with Naam Baldwin. I don't know if you know him. Maybe look him up. He'll be cool to come on your podcast too. He's awesome. He's an ex-free diver. Could hold his breath for about 8 minutes.
Wow.
And does a lot of training. He's got his own sort of program up in the Gold Coast, but he did a lot of training with professional teams. And last year, like, he did a bit of training with the Roosters, they won the premiership. Training with an AFL team, they won the premiership. And he's got really good results in how to slow your breathing down and all the heart rate variability and promoting the body into parasympathetic state and promote recovery. Red light I do all the time, the Juve light.
Yeah.
Got that in my bathroom. So I do that basically every day. The hydrogen water is huge as well. I think it gives you a lot of extra energy and input into this in cellular energy. What else? There's a product called Nutrigenomics, which is pretty cool, which
I think I've heard of it.
LifeVantage has been distributing, and it just works on three different aging pathways. So that's
this the NAD product.
That NAD is coming out.
Okay,
it's about to come out. Then there's NRF1, NRF2.
Yeah.
So it works on mitochondria energy within the cell.
Is this an American company?
American company.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
So I've been taking their products for only about 3 weeks now.
Okay.
Notice my dreams have been really vivid.
Yeah.
Which is cool. They're peer reviewed, science backed. You know, I always like to, my foundation is good nutrition, and then, you know, people call it biohacking, or I like to call it bioalign. So you're aligning the body with natural therapies. So that's basically about it. And then, you know, magnesium and zinc, and so I cycle those. So I'm not always taking tablets all the time. I always like to cycle it through every few months.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's so interesting, the Juve light stuff, or the red light therapy, people haven't heard of it. We started researching it while the Juve company came up. It's actually crazy, the skin conditions that they're healing with. It's got like a really strong anti-aging effect in the research. And it's almost absurd. Like if you looked at the, if you looked at the packet or the packaging that comes with the red light and the benefits that are on it, you almost think that like this is a crock of shit. Like,
is it just a spectrum of red? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a particular like, yeah, spectrum of red.
It's not just like a red glow.
No.
It's like a near and far infrared light, and plus the infrared red, but it's I don't know how far it is, but it's I find it just gives me energy. Like it just waking up in the morning, just I don't need coffee if I don't want to.
Wow.
Like, it's just it's pretty cool. It's, it decreases inflammation and all those things that you mentioned on the box, like skin, hair, nails, clarity, like cellular energy, all that type of stuff it promotes. And it's a natural, it's like, when the sun goes down, it's almost red, you sit out there for 10 minutes, you feel great.
Yeah, it's like the one spectrum of light, I think, that we get the least of these days.
Yeah.
Is it the one like right before the sun goes down and when the sun comes up?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly, but where it is in the light spectrum with the sun, obviously the sun has the whole thing, but I know the intensity of the red light is like particularly, or interacts specifically with the mitochondria in the cells, and that's why you get that massive energy boost when they use it. And that's like one of the most common side effects people say after they use the light is like, I feel super energized because of its interaction with the mitochondria. It's really interesting stuff.
It's cool.
It is cool. Yeah. It's definitely cool. Second question.
Yep.
What is like a routine, or I mean, you mentioned a bunch of them there, but maybe one you haven't mentioned that you feel like, you do that and the day is like really, really well fulfilled.
So normally I'd wake up naturally without an alarm anymore. And I do like a minute of that breathing. So I just breathe through my belly first, diaphragmatic breathing. So belly, chest, and just nice, slow, rhythmic breathing for a minute. And then I go downstairs and I have a big glass of water, really, either with a squeeze of lemon or a pinch of Celtic sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
So I hydrate my body straight away. And then I make my daughter's breakfast. But then I go up and I have a shower and I use the red light. So that's my routine, short routine, basically every morning.
Mm.
So I, breathing, oxygenate the body, hydrate the body, and then wake up to the red light, and then I'm ready to take on the day.
Well, how long's the red light session?
There's a timer on it. I set it at 18, 20 minutes, but in the morning it's pretty short, and it's only 5 to 6 minutes I spend in there.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just that, time... gives me time to wake up and just gives that little bit of an energy hit. Then I jump in a cold shower after that.
Yeah.
So I spend a few minutes in the red light, then I have a cold shower. Sometimes only for like 20, 30 seconds really, because it's winter. Mm. But that's all you need. And I've found doing that consistently, my immune system's been a lot stronger. I haven't had even a sore throat at all through the whole of winter in the last couple of years.
COVID just, safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. Improve your immune system.
Yeah.
Just by having 10, 20 second cold shower.
Yeah.
And then turn it on hot,
Yeah. Do you, I guess it's kind of a timely question, but not a timeless question, I should say, but for the players now playing without the crowds, or they're playing with really small crowds or something.
Small crowds now, but they weren't early,
Could you imagine how much do you think that would affect you in your game day? Because I know that I'm watching the NBA now and they've got a digital crowd.
I know.
That's crazy.
But no fans?
Yeah, it's light. You can just you stream in, you pay money to stream in, and you're on the full board as a digital person, like watching the game, which... they're playing awesome. Like, they're into the game. Like, the other day, like, Giannis, headbutted some guy in the face. Fully into
that's
the game.
That's what you want to say. Good. Perfect.
Yeah. So, you probably thought about it, right? Could I play with no fans?
It would be strange, for sure. In the early part of the COVID lockdowns, they had cardboard cutouts of fans in the stands. So, you could pay a membership and you could have your face on that was funny. It would have been strange because the crowd does give you so much energy. The atmosphere as you run out and the cheers, it does give you energy without doubt. So it would be strange to experience nothing and silence as you're playing a game, And that's more, again, the mental side coming back into the game. The great players can just go about their business and not worry about anything else. The other players, I've got to play another game, there's no crowd and I can't get up for it, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, because I watched the, I think it was the FA Cup final. And obviously with football in England, it's just it's always, the crowd is, it's like one of the craziest crowd sports in the world, right? and like they score and it's just nothing, dead silence.
I know. They normally go nuts and they're singing. That would be like, you know, the English crowd is phenomenal.
Yeah. Always singing.
Imagine
right?
nothing there.
Yeah. Like they run over to the goalpost and all you see is just a sea of people going nuts and like, you know, streamers and everything. This is like a mid-season game, you know, whatever. And like, this is the FA Cup final, like hugest game. And they score a goal.
That was weird,
and all you can hear is like five people cheering.
Yeah. Where does he run? Does he like run to the crowd and like, he scores the goal?
Like it's the same thing. They just, run and scream and look at the coaching staff or whatever. Yeah.
That's strange.
But like you said, I think the best players, they know it's the same weight. It's just as important. They're just not there. And so we have a job to do. We're going to like get this job done.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think it reminded people though that the fans are part of the sport. The sport's not the same without the fans.
Totally.
Yeah. Like you can play it, but you need the fans.
That's why Peter Vlandis, the boss of the NRL, wanted to bring them back as soon as he could, you know what I mean? Just to try and create some, atmosphere and enjoyment for them as well.
Do you think, because obviously the NRL probably hasn't experienced the growth of other sports like AFL, what do you think would need to change for the NRL to get to the level of like, say, the AFL?
Well, I think, it comes with good leadership, doesn't it? In any business, sporting organisation, and we've had good leaders in the past, but probably ones that were focusing on footy more so, where it's a business, it's a total business now, and we need money in the bank, we need to build up some revenue, just like the AFL have, you know, and they had someone in Andrew Demetrio a long time ago who did that for them, and look where they are now, you know, they're... Financially, they're streaks ahead of any other sport in Australia.
It's huge.
And then our new guy, Peter Vlandis, he's got a real good business background, racing background. So he's apparently going to put a lot of things in place so where our revenue is going to be saved each year and so we can have money in the bank and start to, I don't know, expand but make the game a lot more solid.
Yeah, I think it surprised everyone this year when it's so successful and it's like, hundreds of thousands of fans, and they're like, oh, cool, how much money have you got? Enough for 3 weeks.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
3 weeks.
Terrible, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the sport's been going for 100 years.
It has.
You'd hope they've got more than 3 weeks. It's like a brand new business.
It's true, I know. It's right.
We've been saving for 100 years.
100 years.
About $300 a year or something. it's crazy. I think the mindset that people would take is that, oh, it'll never get that big. But I just think AFL's doing it with like Melbourne, Victoria and Perth, really, like two
crazy
states. But we've got Queensland and New South Wales, like massive states. It can definitely get there. There's no reason it can't. And like obviously the people that are into it love it. So there's definitely more of those people.
Mm.
But yeah, like you said, it's like a business. Like once you're in business, you can kind of see the cracks a little bit more and how they didn't quite pull it off. And the same was true with the NBL. Like they absolutely sunk it and... And the same with the soccer, like the NSL, now the A-League, both went on hiatus for 2 or 3 years, the soccer and the basketball, till they had new owners with money who were like, we have to grow this. And if you know anything about the Dana White story, he bought the UFC for $2 million, sunk $65 million into it, to the point where the guys, they turned around and they said, okay, we're $65 million in the hole, plus the four we spent on it, like $70 million. And it's not working, so we're going to shut it down, go get a sale price for it. He shopped around in 24 hours. The best price he could get for it was $7 million. So they would have lost over $60 million US dollars in like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, but they refused to say no and they grew it to what, $7 billion now? So
amazing.
They were $65 million US dollars in the hole.
Mm.
They came out and look what it is today. So it can happen. It can definitely happen. If it can happen with cage fighting, in a casino, it can... any sport can do it, really.
Yeah,
I think.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So, third question is: there anything recently that you changed your mind on that for a while you held as a strong belief?
I like to look at both sides of the view of arguments. I always read and listen to podcasts on nutrition a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, there's always the debate of paleo,
carnivore,
keto, vegan, vegetarian. And I've listened to all points of view and all sides. But my belief is that everyone's individual and, any of those diets could work for someone individually.
Definitely.
But there's not one size fits all, you know what I mean? So I've had a mate who did the carnivore experience for 8 months and his blood work got better.
Mm.
But someone else, that certainly didn't work, you know what I mean? Or someone with that's vegan, it could work for them, but doesn't work for someone else. So that's why I believe you're your own test case, you know. Do your own testing, do your own blood work, experiment with this stuff. But my thing is with nutrition is I give a variety of all those, you know. So I have four steps that I live by, and that's step one is the source of your food. Get to know where it comes from. So if I'm eating animal products, they've got to be pasture-raised. Got to be healthy animals first and foremost. If it's plant foods, then it's got to be local where I can, and in season.
Mm-hmm.
And then step two is to cook with the right oils, the process of what you're eating. So mm-hmm. to cook with the right oils, and if you're roasting, slow cook it.
Okay.
Step three is to decrease my consumption of processed foods and grains and crap food,
mm-hmm.
packet foods. And then step four is the intermittent fast. So they're my four steps. And I'm not in any one lane in nutrition. So all those ones I just mentioned, I'm not stuck in one of those.
Yeah.
I'm in all of those, but my four steps are key. The source of my food, the process of my food, decrease the crap, and intermittent fast.
Yeah.
How do you think intermittent fasting could work for an athlete that I'm sure you eat way less now than you used to?
I do. And I'm 7 kilos lighter when I play, but I have to really push heavy weights and eat heaps to keep muscle bulk on because I'm just lean naturally.
That's for sure.
But the longer I go into a fast, the more clearer I feel, the more focused, the more mental energy I have. All this natural energy just comes out because the body switched from burning sugars and now it's switched to burning fats, which is the primary fuel source. And it's more of a premium fuel source. Mm. But not many people get into fat burning or ketosis anymore because they eat 6-7 times a day and it's standard Australian diet, high in grains and carbohydrates. So, but the body's designed to do both. You know, these people also with people heavy keto, they're all obsessed with ketones in the blood and testing themselves. The body's designed to do both, burn sugars and burn fats. So I like to fluctuate between both of those. So it would have been interesting playing professional sport to try and play on a semi-fasted state to feel that clarity and focus going into a game. But I'm a lean guy too, so I'll have to be mindful of body weight and that. But also, you know, when you are fasting, you know, your growth hormone's through the roof. You know, I've even blood tested myself on a 24-hour fast and my growth hormone was 8 times higher than when I'm in the eating state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just there to see, 8 times higher. I was like, wow, that means my body's in full repair mode, recovery mode. So that's why sometimes I like training in a faster state as well, because I know there's optimization of hormones there, that are building blocks that recover a lot quicker. Which is interesting.
Did you fast when you were repairing yourself from the back injuries?
Well, no, because I wasn't into it then. I only started fasting probably 3.5 years ago and I was retired.
Yep.
And the reason why I got into it was because I went on a motorbike ride and I managed my L4-5 disc bulge for 8 years the rest of my career. And I still had a bit of a bulge there. Went on a motorbike ride, come back, my back was so sore. And normally I could get it back within 3 or 4 days, but it just wouldn't go away. So I got an MRI and the doctor's like, mate, you got a 1 centimeter piece of floating disc that's broken off there. And it was giving me trouble. I couldn't extend it, couldn't break out into a run. Anyway, this is when I started getting the research around fasting. And I said to the doc, I said, I'm going to try and let my body break it down naturally. And he sort of laughed at me. I'm sure I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I'm sure you're going to book that operation in. You know, I started fasting, you know, 1 meal a day, 2 meals a day, 3 meals a day. Minimum was 12 hours, 16-8 quite regularly. I did a 3-day fast every now and again, 1 day of no food. I'd mix it up, gave the body variety, so didn't do the same thing every day. MRI on my back 10 months later, and that piece had completely dissolved. The body had metabolized it, you know, and that's through autophagy, you know what I mean? The cellular cleansing and healing. The body ate that as an energy source first. And that's all the research that you read in science today, that the body cleans itself up and all the damage on old cells in the body. That's when autophagy kicks in, which is a 16-hour and beyond mark of fasting. That, you know, it goes to that and eats those as an energy source first. So And that's, you know, two things that I experienced with fasting is optimization of growth hormone and, you know, cellular cleansing. And that's happened within my body. So I know it's a pretty powerful tool that you can use in your daily lives. And guess what? It's free. You know, no GP will tell you, it's, you know, it's practice fasting because you won't be back there.
Yeah. You know, if you almost weren't sitting across from me telling me that story, I would just, and I heard it through another source, about this bullshit. He didn't get the scan, or like it's just some made up fable to like get, but here we are, and it's real. It's pretty cool.
I've got this image of my two spine photos here. I'll show you, and you can see the difference in the healthiness of each of them. You know, one when I'm 34, and it's much healthier than when I'm 27. I suppose being in my prime.
Yeah. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
And then last thing, is there a book that you like to recommend for people that have made like an impact on your life, or a couple of books, or?
There's heaps. There's a couple. I don't know if you there's a book called Biology of Belief, and that's a pretty amazing book. Okay.
What's that about?
That is
kind of sounds like a Sam Harris book.
He's a New Zealand guy. We're going to get on the podcast. You should go for him. He's a great guy. I'm just name escapes me at the moment.
Is he a scientist or a philosopher?
He's a biologist. Bruce Lipton. Lipton, that's it. Bruce Lipton, his book was amazing. Another one, if you're interested in fasting, is the book by Dr. Jason Fung.
Yeah.
It's called The Complete Guide to Fasting.
Yeah.
That was pretty amazing. What have I just read? Dr. Mark Hyman's book, his current book, Food Fix.
Yeah.
That will blow you away.
Yeah. What was his book before that?
What the Heck Should I Eat? Or What the Heck Should I Cook? He's got heaps.
Got
heaps. So I love his messaging. He's a real good guy that's doing good things in America.
Was that Mark's Daily Apple? Was that the same guy?
That's not Rob Wolf. That's Mark's Daily Apple is Mark Sisson.
Yes. Mark Sisson. That's what I was thinking.
He's good.
Okay. Okay. And
On the fasting book, what do you think is the easiest way for someone to start? Do you think you go for like the in the plunge, you go 3 days, or you start for like 3 hours?
Definitely don't do the 3 days straight away. You want to train your body that burns up the glycogen to go to fat. So the minimum, just do 12 hours. So if you finish eating at 8 o'clock last night, don't eat till 8 in the morning. That will be the start, you know, whole fresh foods, and then 12 hours. Give your digestion a rest daily. And then, you know, if you're feeling good and you're not hungry, then just extend the window by an hour.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're feeling hungry, then just eat. That's how I judge it, you know. If I'm feeling hungry, because some days you're hungrier than others, it's just natural. Yeah, but, I 12 hours, I'm feeling hungry now, I might eat.
But you must push through hunger to go 3 days.
Well, hunger comes in waves. In the 3 day one, yes, because the hunger comes in waves. Yeah. So once you beat the wave and it goes away, you'll be so in tune with what's going on. Yeah. You'll be alert. Like all this natural energy comes out, and like the few that I've done on day three, literally I'm jumping out of bed, just flying. Like if I had a coffee, I'll be climbing the walls. Mm. You can't do coffee.
Yeah,
because you're just so alert and in tune. You know what I mean? And then you start to realize you don't need that much food to survive and thrive. You know, you just that. But the important part is when you do fast and extended fasting, what you put in your body next is vital.
Yeah.
You know? It's got to be some healthy food. Yeah. It's got to be whole fresh food, you know, because the body will just suck that up.
Yeah. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Awesome. Good chat, guys.
So you're doing a few things. You've got, you know, your business and... You know, still working with the Roosters and that other company you mentioned, Change Room.
Yeah, the Change Room program. You can just look us up at changeroom.info there. And MiniFit's my own business, online workouts and on-demand workouts, minifit.com.au.
Yeah, and people can follow you. You post on Instagram fairly regularly. Yeah,
I got my personal one is Minicello001 and my MiniFit one is MiniFit Now.
Awesome.
Yeah. Sick.
Cool. Beautiful, well, guys. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for being on. Appreciate it. Thanks,
Sam. Unreal.
Thanks, mate.
There it is, guys. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode with Aussie sporting legend, Sydney Roosters player Anthony, or former Sydney Roosters player Anthony Minicello. Minnow, thank you so much for being on the show. It was an incredible show. Guys, if you love this episode, please share it. Tag us, tag Minicello, tag the Sydney Roosters. And yeah, just share the love. Leave us a 5-star review if you really enjoyed it on iTunes. We really appreciate that. In fact, anyone that leaves us a 5-star review, we send you a free training journal. So all you need to do is screenshot your review, email it in to media@themindmuscleproject.com, and we will send you a free training journal. If you don't know what that is, go to thetrainingjournalbook.com and you can check that out. As well, guys, of course, we were supported today by Manscaped. If you want to groom downstairs in a way that is hygienic, is fashionable, and is appreciated by all women and men, manscaped.com hygiene pack. You can use the code MMP. That's going to get you 20% off no matter where you are in the world. So it's manscaped.com and the code is MMP for 20% off. And then, of course, the best. So now that you've cleaned up downstairs, then you're going to throw on the best gear possible. You're going to look the freshest person in the gym. You're going to have people looking at you sideways going, damn, what is that guy wearing? That's RecGen gear. That's recgen.com. It's got amazing technology. It's got silver lined in the shirts, which is antibacterial. It's an amazing company. Free express shipping worldwide. So anyone in the world can get this product. That's at recgen.com, RECGEN.com. And the code is MMP. Those three letters for 15% off your entire order. Of course, as well, they have a women's line now. You can check that out as well. And like I said at the start, the very minimum, go check them out on Instagram as well. All right, guys, thank you so much for this episode, and we'll speak to you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the Mind Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the Mind Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/theaftershow. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.